I'm Dr. Casey Mixon, Assistant Professor at Valdosta State University's Psychology, Counseling, and Family Therapy Department and Project Director for the Military Families Learning Network Family Development Team. Along with Barry Sobelson, Licensed Family Therapist and MFLN Family Development Programming Coordinator, we invite you to join us for our anchored podcast conversations. We started this podcast in hopes to support and inspire those connected to military families. Each episode focuses on real-life struggles and practical solutions to lessen the harmful ripple effects. We invite you to sit back, relax, and get anchored with us.
Today we have Dr. Megan Arstia Chisholm joining us. Megan's an assistant professor in the educational psychology program in the department that I work at, actually, the Department of Psychology, Counseling, and Family Therapy at Valdosta State University. She was born and raised in South Florida, completed her BA and MA in sociology from the University of Central Florida. She taught at a high school in Florida and also worked as a testing consultant for some time. And then Megan went back to grad school to get her Master's of Science in Instructional Systems and Learning Technology. And then she also got her PhD in Learning and Cognition from Florida State University. Megan's research interests include self-regulation, teacher beliefs, and literacy instruction. And today we're actually going to be talking to Megan about a recent research initiative on dependence in military families who are currently attending college. The study was a response to Dr. Jill Biden's address at the 2016 AERA annual meeting to study and serve military families. Megan and I have been discussing her interest in this area for some time now, and we're really excited to have her talk with us about how far she's come since the interest began. We're excited to have Megan with us and to share more about this important research.
Hey Megan, how's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. So why don't we get started with you telling us a bit about the research and your motivation behind it. What happened for you to get interested in working specifically with dependents of military families that are college-age kids?
Well, like you said, Jill Biden was at the American Educational Research Association meeting last year, speaking about how we need to meet the needs of military families. And I started thinking about all of my students here at Valdosta State that are part of military families and how I haven't really heard much of their stories and was interested to learn more.
Megan talks about hearing Dr. Jill Biden's speech at the 2016 American Educational Research Association. It's also known as AERA. Dr. Biden's speech was called Operation Educate the Educators, recognizing and supporting military-connected students through university-based research, community partnerships, and teacher education programs. Wow, that title is a mouthful, and I think the call for research was pretty extensive, just like the title. Dr. Biden called for researchers in the university community to focus their efforts on military-connected students. Here's a quote from the AERA description of Dr. Biden's address. Approximately 2.4 million military and veteran-connected students are in our K-12 classrooms. These children also, in their way, serve. Despite multiple school moves and parental deployment, military and veteran-connected students show remarkable resilience. Education research and over a decade of experience tells us that schools are essential to providing consistent, sensitive, understanding, and response to the unique needs this very special population of Americans' children. National policy, new research funding, and efforts in over 100 universities are now underway to increase the number of university schools of education that include materials, research, and partnerships focused on students from military and veteran families. Dr. Biden launched Operation Educate the Educators to increase awareness of this group among university schools of education. End quote. And to give you a little bit of history, evidently, Dr. Biden's Operation Educate the Educator is a part of a larger initiative called Joining Forces. This is basically called for federal government, private, and public organizations to really explore ways to support military families. The American Association for Colleges for Teacher Education has an article in 2011, I believe it was put out, and it can be found on our podcast website. And in it, it talks a little bit more about this population of students, the military-connected students. Military-connected students are children, adolescents, and young adults in PK through 12 schools, trade schools, and institutions of higher education who are official dependents of a military service member. While all students come to school with different needs, the children of the armed forces might be viewed as carrying an invisible backpack that is full of unique challenges and yet empty at the same time, requiring purposeful academic and social-emotional support. Military-connected students face various challenges in their schools. Many experience anxiety and depression because of parental deployments or following injury to, or the death, even, of a parent. Elevated stress is common regarding making new friends, adjusting to new schools and communities, and understanding and interpreting new school regulations and policies. Because of frequent moves, students also face academic challenges from adjusting to new curricula, instructional methods, and school climates and cultures. In addition, the school experience can be particularly challenging for military-connected students with disabilities as they navigate the regulations, testing, and resources that vary from district to district, end quote. I'd like to also add that military-connected students' struggles do not stop when they graduate high school, and it's important to continue to support research agendas that not only look at the struggles of military-connected college-age students, but also their strengths, their resilience, what helps them get through, what helps them keep their head up. This type of research can better equip those of us in helping roles and also in academia with information that leads to effective strategies and interventions that assist in positive student outcomes. This is just one way we can honor their service as military-connected family members.
So I threw together a proposal after realizing the research isn't out there as far as what are the needs of military families in college and higher education institutions. So I want to just do an exploratory project just to interview folks and get their stories. But a little bit of background. I actually worked with military personnel straight out of grad school when I was working in a research firm called Cognitive Performance Group in Orlando. It's a veteran-owned research firm, and they did DOD contracts. They worked with the military branches to create cultural competence instruction. First, we had to figure out what is cultural competence working in the military, and so I was part of that interview crew. So going and talking to folks in special forces and doing humanitarian projects, and that was the first time, because I'm not from a military family. I'm from an immigrant family, and no one in my family served. But I gained an appreciation for working with military personnel from those projects, learning about all the great things that the military does that we never hear about in the news. So from there, that research firm liked my work, appreciated my research, and said we could use an instructional designer. What is instructional design? I had no idea. And that's when I went to Florida State to study instructional design and realized, oh wow, there's so much more that we need to understand about just learning and teaching. And my mentor there, Alicia Rorick, she happened to study K-12 teachers, and that's what I did my dissertation on. But when I got here at Valdosta State, I've been given this great opportunity to study whatever I want. So given Jill Biden's speech that inspired me to reach out to my students who either are in the military, have served, or have parents that have been deployed, and study this concept of parental separation. I myself experienced parental separation. My dad was incarcerated when I was about 9 years old, between fourth grade and ninth grade. And so I wanted to see, well, is it the same thing when your parent goes away for one thing, even if they're building bridges in another country, or if they're sitting in a jail cell, is it the same experience or not? And what I found out through these interviews is that they're not the same experience. However, there are some commonalities. In educational research, we have assumed that being apart from your parent is a terrible thing. We've instead researched parental involvement, how to get parents more involved. And now we're actually finding that there's a backlash. There's something called being a helicopter parent, mm-hmm. right, where parents are just all up in their students' business and doing things for them, which decreases their self-efficacy, right?
And disrupts developmentally what they can learn as far as independence, like you said.
Right.
Self-efficacy and whatnot, yeah.
Well, it's funny that you say independence. That was the number one theme that we found in the interviews.
Before Megan and I start discussing self-efficacy, it may be nice to review what that concept really means in the academic world. Self-efficacy is the extent of someone's belief in their own ability to complete tasks and reach goals. This concept of self-efficacy is often reflective of a person's sense of self, sense of confidence, and their ability to exert control over anything from motivations, behavior, and even their social environment. This concept was introduced by Albert Bandura around 1977 in an attempt to contribute to a unified theory of behavior change.
We interviewed 29 different college students over the past year. It was me and a crew of two
and,
other
and
students.
And are these traditional college students? Like, what's the age range there?
So first, to even find these folks, we cast a wide net with a survey. It included some questions about their history and some questions about study habits, and we received responses from students that were 18 years old to 60 years old.
Okay.
So we included non-traditional students as well.
Good, because obviously they have a story to tell too. Yeah.
And out of these 29 folks that agreed to be interviewed, first they had to check the box that they experienced parental separation. Give me some more details about that, and then check the box that they're interested in being interviewed. Out of those 29, some have very complicated stories, like one woman served in the military but had a father that was incarcerated and a mom that was deployed, you know, so different types of experiences. It's hard to tease out. But what was clear and interesting is that those that experienced parental separation actually had higher self-efficacy, significantly higher self-efficacy than those that never experienced parental separation for any reason. In particular, those that experienced parental separation due to deployment in the military had higher intrinsic value for education and the courses they were taking. So these are questions like, when I fail at a test, I learn from my mistakes. Or even though it doesn't feel good to fail on a test, I learn from my mistakes. I enjoy the subjects that I take, things like that. So I was like, what is this about? You know, and I was able to tap more into that during the interviews. And apparently there's a trend that if you come from a military family, it's either books or boots. It's something like you either enlist into the military at a young age or you go to college. There's no choice other than that. Even though it seems like the parents are putting pressure on the students, it's just part of the culture.
Part of the military culture.
Yeah, part of the military culture.
So can we back up for a second, though? Because that's really interesting that you're highlighting the books or boots culture. And then when you were telling how you landed in this type of research, that the organization that you worked for in Orlando,
Cognitive Performance Group,
that they talked a lot about military culture, right, and cultural competence in the military. Can you speak to that a bit more?
Yeah, well, the cultural competence piece was actually more about how can you enter a culture, effectively communicate your needs, and investigate their needs in order to complete a mission successfully. That's what that cultural competence piece was. So this is mostly humanitarian missions. At least that's what they told me, that we were trying to foster.
And this particular cultural competence training was more geared toward the military personnel.
Right, so it's cross-cultural training.
Okay.
Cross-cultural competence, which actually has very similar constructs to the self-regulation study piece that I'm looking at, including self-efficacy. So believing that I can complete a mission is very similar to I can pass this class.
Or I can get through my parent being deployed for 3 months or 6 months or... You know, like, this is doable for our family, too.
And that this is temporary. I understand that these are retrospective interviews, and so it's hard to understand and have a truthful description of how they felt as a child, how these students felt as children when their parents were deployed. But they oftentimes describe not really understanding, what was happening the first time, but then after initial deployment, kind of expecting, okay, well, this is temporary, they're going to come back. I know other people that have gone through this and feeling like it was part of the culture. One negative thing that I did find, so far I've talked about the independence, you know, these adaptive behaviors that the college students have experienced despite parental separation. But one negative thing or maladaptive behavior that I found was social isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And over in the interviews, what was mentioned was that there's no military culture on the campus that they're at.
Right.
Even though there's a base not too far from here. But as far as on campus among students, there is no place for them to go. It wasn't the same feel. They had trouble making friends when they came to Colorado. So that's one piece. And so that message, going back to what Jill Biden was saying, how can we better serve military families? Like, okay, you know, we're doing a great job helping folks with applications and scholarships, mm-hmm. but then when they actually get to campus, it's like, how do I get my financial aid? How do I get my books? How do I make friends? How do I deal with housing?
That transitional support is lacking in the pool of that.
Yeah, they spoke about not feeling they belonged and then wanting to just get the degree.
Mm-hmm.
And compared to some folks in my sample that experienced parental separation for other reasons. So half of them, you know, experienced things like a death of a parent or parental incarceration or some other thing, and there wasn't as much of a need for specific resources on how to figure out college and how to figure out this culture.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't so much of a different culture or culture shock.
That makes sense. That makes sense, though.
Yeah, so that's the higher ed implication, right? As I'm typing up my implication section, you know, that's what institutions of higher education need to know, is that there are these students on your campus that essentially come from another culture,
mm-hmm.
and they need help navigating this culture. And that can be said for many of us, right, that whether we're first-generation college students, in some cases, it's literally a different language that's being used, right? You talked about deliverables earlier,
mm-hmm.
you know, being, you know, assignments or missions to complete, right?
Mm-hmm.
It might just be a different language issue.
And I know, too, I was actually just having a conversation with another colleague today about programs that work in pro-military universities, not to say that any university is anti-military, but that they have more supportive resources for military student populations, either being veterans who are retired and coming in as non-traditional college students, or being college students who come from military families. And one of the things that was really interesting in learning and talking about various programs out there is that when there is kind of a centralized hub, kind of like a veterans or a military resource center within the university, that one thing that happens is that those who are connected to the military kind of congregate there, because they do find, even if they're coming for financial aid or whatnot, people who might be in the lobby or in the waiting areas, they are able to connect and socialize and build and form lasting friendships just by virtue of there being some centralized area where a lot of people who have similar experience who are embedded in that culture, that military right. culture that you're talking about, and they find friends there. And that's another level of support that colleges, universities, training institutions can provide, but it's not even something that's planned. It's just something that happens, like an indirect consequence.
I worry that because we can't necessarily tie one of those numbers that institutions like retention or something or graduation rate, that these initiatives won't be funded, that they won't be brought to fruition, because like I said from the results, and yes, it's one sample, but these students are motivated, they are enjoying their studies, and they are efficacious, like they will get their work done and graduate probably with a GPA.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the social piece, which you and I know is important, mm-hmm. but how can we communicate this to, I don't know how I can communicate it to administrators that we need, you know,
funders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that social isolation is not good mm-hmm. for students, that there are emotional issues and psychological development, you know, that needs to happen at this age,
mm-hmm.
college students. Maybe, you know, having a hub or a central place. Not exactly like a veterans affairs, but
mm-hmm.
something maybe closer to the network that you have.
Yeah. Who's out there? That's true too.
Megan and I discuss the social piece that is important and impactful in not only military personnel, both active and retired, who are students, but also military dependent students that can be spouses or children in college atmospheres. I wanted to give a bit more context about this subject matter and kind of where my thoughts were on it. Military personnel and their family often find a sense of connection and camaraderie with other military families. Some stories are only told and only understood amongst military members who have shared common experiences. Often a bond can be formed among military personnel and their families based on their service and their sacrifice to our country. Integrating back into civilian life or in environments such as academia or in colleges can be quite challenging when the connections to the military are lost or services that were once provided during the time that they were connected to the military are no longer available. It is often difficult for civilians to understand, as these two groups don't necessarily have shared common experiences. One way to combat reintegration difficulties for military families involves creating supportive environments that not only promote inclusion, but also create a space for deeper understanding and appreciation for the level of sacrifice involved in military service, especially related to the struggles and the perseverance necessary to stand strong in the aftermath of war or transitions related to military life. Although there are many instances in which civilians recognize heroic soldiers and military family sacrifice, those sentiments can sometimes fail to truly acknowledge the complexities of what military life can entail. And this can foster further disconnection between military and veterans and civilians. This disconnect can spill over into the transitions that take place for military personnel and their families as they transition into higher education atmosphere. And that's really one of the components that Megan and I are referring to. How do we convey this to administrators of academic institutions? How do we make sure that student veterans resource centers are acknowledging this and informing their activities and services accordingly?
With the Military Families Learning Network, like one of the things that we are striving to do is for there to be, even if it's virtually online, is to have a place where people can come together and they're unified not only in their struggles but in their successes, like what's going well, because we've learned and we know as educators that can be infectious and can be really good for our self-efficacy.
Chat with each other on the network?
In our webinars and in our live programming that's on the APN system, there's chat pods, and so there's a lot of conversation during live presentations that go on, which is really helpful. And one of the things that we do as kind of support staff for MFLN is look at what might be useful during the and sometimes come up with alternate resources, like a resource like a checklist or sometimes just like a blog overview of that conversation, and here's what other people who were involved in the training said, so that those who watch the archive trainings and programmings that they can still maybe reap the benefits of what happened in the chat pods. So yes, a little bit. And then also in our virtual conferences, we're providing this year, and it'll be in September, and we're providing opportunities for there to be conversations that happen, even though people are all over the world who are attending, which is kind of neat. But then also there is something to be said about face-to-face interaction. So we're trying to kind of take the qualities of face-to-face interactions and figure out nice spaces to facilitate what transpires. Like if you go to a traditional conference, mm-hmm. like part of the inspiring conversations that happen between sessions, right. A lot of research initiatives and ideas were born over dinner and snacks and in the hallways and sometimes in the bathrooms over candy. Anyway, so it's interesting, but to me that's a great idea. It's an initiative that I think
you just gave me an idea, because we do have the Campus Connect system here at Valdosta State, mm-hmm. which is for student organizations, and even if there wasn't a physical location for students to get together and exchange ideas, that maybe there could just be a Campus Connection group where they can email, chat, post, mm-hmm. get information, exchange information. the two students that worked with me this semester, Brianna and Aria, they actually both are going to graduate school to become military psychologists.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right. And they both came from military families. So
what programs?
So Brianna's coming. Yeah, she's staying here for the IO program. Okay. So that might be something that she could actually bring to life. Aria is still applying to do.
So IO programs can have a military psychology specialization?
Oh, well, I don't know about our program. As you know, it just takes some doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I've worked with a lot of IO psychologists because they will create either the testing or evaluation, like selection of personnel through IO, and then sorting of tasks, the IO psychology, and as well as evaluation of performance.
So there's a lot of overlap there.
There definitely is. Complementary. I mean, it's an organization, right?
Yeah, very much. Complementary kind of relationships that are happening. Yeah, that's really interesting.
I was curious about the types of research questions asked in this study and suggested that Megan share with us some of the responses the participants provided through quotes that she was able to capture.
I had several research questions. The first research question is about self-regulation. Do students who experience parental separation while growing up experience lower self-regulation once they get to college? So I used this survey. It had about 45 questions on it about self-efficacy, intrinsic value of learning, test anxiety, cognitive strategies, and then self-regulation in general. Those were the topics covered, and they would show a statement on the survey, and students would have to rate their agreement with that statement about themselves. I found differences in these two areas between students who experienced parental separation, those that did not, self-efficacy and intrinsic value. Students that experienced parental separation had higher self-efficacy for learning and studying and had more intrinsic value than those that did not. So these are the kinds of statements. For example, I know that I will be able to learn the material for this class. Those students that experienced parental separation had more efficacy. They felt more confident that they will be able to learn material for this class. Other statements like, I expect to do very well in this class. So they just felt more confident in general in their abilities to excel academically. In terms of intrinsic value, they also felt like they value the subject or the material. For example, statements from this section included, understanding this subject is important to me. I think that what we are learning in this class is interesting. I think I will be able to use what I learned in this class in other classes. So not only did they value it in general, they thought it was more useful, more interesting, and important to them. The other areas, however, there were no significant differences. So there was no difference between those that experienced parental separation and test anxiety. That was really interesting. However, when I looked at those that just experienced parental deployment, they were higher in test anxiety, so maybe grades are more important or there's more value associated with the test itself. There was no differences in cognitive strategies across the two groups, and there were no differences in self-regulation, which is what I was mostly interested in. There was a difference in one statement in particular, however, and this statement said, I often find that I have been reading for class, but don't know what it is all about. So those students that did experience parental separation had higher scores on this item. They often were reading for class but didn't know what it was all about. That really is measuring reading comprehension and monitoring. A lot of us experience this where we get to the bottom of the page and don't remember what we have read.
After capturing and reviewing the answers to the research questions, Megan and her team were able to identify some adaptive strategies and behaviors and tease out underlying themes within their responses. I asked Megan to share these themes.
Some of the adaptive comments were really inspiring and motivating. For example, students wanted to then go on and study the military and go on and work with the military, serve with military families. One student even said that her father being deployed didn't have effect on her as far as what he did. It had an effect because she was trying to do military psychology. So even though she didn't find it negatively impacting her childhood, it did inspire her motivation for her career. Another theme that we found in the interviews was independence. students finding that having a parent away from them push them to learn things quicker on their own and then be more efficacious or confident. For example, this student said, "When you get older, you realize these people give 110%, and that becomes something that's really important to you. And that's really important to me now, because I lose motivation very easily if something is too tough. I'm like, I want to do it, but it's so difficult, I can't do it. And then I think about all these people who give 110%, 120%, and they got it done, and they can do it." In this case, their parent was deployed, and that served as a model, a role model for them, something to strive for, and to continue to work hard in academics. Another theme we found that was adaptive was resiliency. For example, this student said, "I feel like if I had not gone through everything I had gone through, even though I thought it was horrible when I was going through it, looking back on it now, I would not have appreciated music as much as I do now as a freeing factor of my life." And this is coming from a music major who's studying it academically and striving to finish their Bachelor of Arts degree. Another adaptive theme that we found was expressing gratitude. This came out in a lot of interviews, both in the deployment group and the other parental separation group. The student said, "And so I'm just grateful that I'm here, and I don't get sad like, wow. I don't think about what my life could be, but I don't say, I wish I was back in China. I wish that I never came here. And I love my family too," she says. This is coming from a student who was adopted at a young age and separated from her biological family and is now able to live and study in the United States.
Megan's findings suggested social isolation to be a maladaptive strategy, and it made me curious. So I asked if she'd provide an example of social isolation as a barrier from the interviews.
So when interviewing these students and having these conversations, there were definitely some barriers and challenges that they identified. For example, social isolation came up. One student, in fact, said, "I had a couple friends growing up, and they could barely deal with me because I was so active and I was off the walls. And dare I say I was annoying, which I know I was. Teachers would have to talk to my parents because I was always into everything and not keeping my hands to myself when I was out there. So now, here in college, I have trouble making friends."
I'm not that well trained in ethnographic kind of research, but I wanted it to have more of that kind of feeling where I get someone in the room and then basically, and it ranges. Someone will, you can just so tell that they've gone to therapy or talked at their church or somewhere where they can, from beginning to end, tell you their story. And, you know, maybe you can ask questions for clarifying details. And then some folks where you really have to read the script and ask, you know, so how did you feel when your dad left? How did you feel when they got back? And, you know, it's hard sometimes. But
and where they may be on their journey of processing all that stuff that's happened. Like you said, is this the first conversation that they've had about their past? Is the first opportunity that they've had to reflect and understand the impacts that may be happening as you're talking to them too?
Yeah.
And being sensitive to that as a researcher is a skill set that's amazing and also incredibly difficult.
That's the other thing. So I'm not a counseling psychologist, but wow, the need for some kind of group it really came out in these interviews. You know, there was tears, there were laughs, whatever, but if I could just get, you know, subject A and subject B to talk to each other and realize how similar their stories are.
Again, that peer-to-peer support.
Yeah, that would be great.
Need for it.
And, you know, I think I came into it kind of like all of our biases, right, with an ageist bias, thinking, okay, when I talk to someone that's 45 years old, they'll be able to explain their story to me. And it was not the case. Like you said, some folks are at different parts of their journey, and just because they are going back to school now after initially trying and maybe serving themselves, you know, it was the first time that they talked about, oh yeah, I guess my dad did get deployed at the same time that I started hating school, you know, or something like that. But
some aha moments happen, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But, it, like I said, now at the college level, everyone seemed to be really interested in school and academics, even if they had a hard time growing up. And I was also trying to get some information about role models and mentors. And it was interesting that folks always set their parents as a role model.
Like, across the board?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so even students that reported their dad or their mom was incarcerated, they would still pick them because, oh, well, they told me what not to do. They showed me what not to do as a non-example or anti-role model. I don't know what the term is for that, but
that's interesting.
Yeah. Always pick their parents, and then maybe later talk about, well, I had a really good teacher that got me interested in biology or whatever my major is, but when I asked role models specifically,
parents came up.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Another kind of negative thing was when I analyzed the survey data, which was asking questions about study strategies and such, when I looked at those that just experienced a parent being deployed, they actually had significantly higher reports of test anxiety. Okay. I don't know what that's about. I mean, there's some speculation, right, that, you know, if maybe they, you know, their parent had situational anxiety, then they might have picked up on that too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's just for further research.
Right. And that's the lovely part of qualitative research. I mean, learn about people's experiences and kind of group some common themes, it tells you where other areas of research need to happen.
That's why I try to use mixed methods for this. So first with the huge battery of questions from the survey, and then from the specific stories too. So that was something that came out in the survey that I didn't really find out in time for the interviews to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were to, and I do have gift cards to do 30 more. So if I can get participants, maybe if you're out there listening right now, and if you qualify as a college student who has experienced a parent being deployed, you know, I can interview you. My email address is mcarrastia@valdosta.edu.
And we'll put it on the Learn Event page too, that and some other complimentary resources, articles.
I can link my presentation for APA.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, so I'm presenting these results at the upcoming 125th Annual American Psychological Association Conference in Washington, D.C. next month, and I'll have a poster there, and hopefully I'll get some more feedback, have a better idea of where to go next.
Lots of places you can go. Lots of different sidewalks that you can stroll with this. But that's so great. That's so wonderful.
I actually just read that.
Yeah, well, you know, there's good to doing research. Okay, besides the two findings that you just like talked about right then, was there anything when you were either collecting students' stories or any piece, any time, what are you doing, like the literature review? Was there anything that was just kind of surprising to you about this particular research population?
Yeah, I think kind of what I said earlier about, you know, even talking to the non-traditional students, how the therapeutic nature of the interviews was really surprising to me. I wasn't prepared for talking about these sensitive issues as much as I thought I was. This is my first really big project on my own as a scholar without a supervisor and someone to debrief these kind of interviews. So it was surprising to me how much emotion came out during the interviews and then how much I held on to myself. And, you know, like I said, I have my own experience with my dad being incarcerated and how talking to these individuals kind of brought back some of those feelings, but mostly in a good way, you know, like, oh, I've come this far, and I hope I can help others and be a mentor to others.
Mm-hmm.
So, I also really enjoyed working with students on this project. And
the students that assisted you? Yeah.
We got to present preliminary results. We just had four interviews at the time, and we just presented them as different case studies at the Georgia Educational Research Association in Augusta in October. And that was cool because they used one theory and they kind of just laid it on top of the four cases and put them along a continuum. Continuum was a self-determination theory, which basically posits that, you know, on one side you can be completely externally regulated, that you just you just clock in for that paycheck and you don't care about your job, you just have to do it. Or you can be completely intrinsically motivated that the task is so part of your identity that you don't even realize you're working. And based on these four different cases of students who experienced parental deployment, they all had part of military identities, and some of them just wanted to pursue military psychology, for example, or something within that culture. And then others, you know, were like, it didn't really affect me that much. Yeah, my dad was in the military, but I'm interested in forensics or something, just unrelated, seemingly unrelated. Mm-hmm. And then accordingly, like, they saw school that way. They felt about school just like, okay, I'm just doing this so I can get that friend's job, versus some people like, I've been in school so long, this is part of my identity, I can't imagine not being in school. Mm-hmm. So that was just that's their exercise in research mm-hmm. methods and plotting different data points supporting different theories. So.
And what was your observation, because both of your research assistants came from military families, right?
Yeah.
What did you observe or really their story to tell, but from your perspective, was that impactful to work with people who also were coming from the military?
Definitely. I really appreciate having them during the interviews because it added credibility, right? And a sense of security, I feel like, for some of the students that were trying to open up about their experiences and needing, like, okay, somewhere in the room has had a similar experience. But also amongst themselves, like, they connected so much. And of course, when you are in a research team, you spend a lot of time together, mm-hmm. but having a similar experience, having a similar goal of being military psychologists, really brought them together, even though they didn't know each other at the beginning of the project. So I of course, being a social person, I liked observing that.
Mm-hmm.
And having them, it was like my mini group.
an unintended consequence.
Yes.
But so positive. That's great. And something that is close to their heart in that it was a part of their upbringing and culture.
And even though they don't want to be researchers mm-hmm. when they grow up, I think it helped them realize, like, okay, this is closer to what grad school is going to be like. Do I really want to do this? So it helped them.
Well, what's next? What's next for future research? Are you still inspired, as inspired as you were after the AERA conference, or where are you at now?
I'm actually going to step back and take a break from looking at it and try to take some time away from the data and then come back to it in a few months to see if, you know, am I just looking for certain answers because I have a deadline? You know, I want to take some of that pressure off myself as a researcher and eliminate some of that bias that I have right now and look back in a few months, reread the transcripts. And it's a lot of reading. I mean, they're like 60 pages each at least. And
how many hours on average were the...
I mean, they're about an hour each.
Mm-hmm. But still, that's a lot of reading.
You can get a lot in an hour, so...
But you want to prevent tunnel vision.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I'm working with some other colleagues, get some other perspectives, have them read it. So, yeah, and like you said, I don't know which path to go down yet. Mm-hmm. I envision maybe a book coming out of this mm-hmm. instead of, but the path to a book is a research article, honestly. So I somehow have to, like, condense everything really into a tiny little package and then before I'm able to expand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're excited for you, Megan.
Thanks.
We're really excited because we can see you in the halls and get pretty consistent updates when you're ready to talk. I know sometimes when you do research, you're just like, I don't want to talk about it because I'm in a place where I don't want to talk about it. But we feel very fortunate to have you here and for you to want to research a topic area that is near and dear to our hearts, obviously, and let us know how we can help support you.
Alright, thanks.
In my own exploration of academic literature that focuses on military families and their children, I came across a book called A Battle Plan for Supporting Military Families. In it is a chapter titled Lessons Learned and Future Recommendations for Conducting Research with Military Children and Families. You can find a link to this abstract on today's podcast episode website. This book chapter is a part of the Risk and Resilience in Military and Veteran Families book series. I wanted to read an excerpt found, I believe, on page 265 in that particular chapter. When the U.S. military began combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2002, little was known about how military children and families would be affected by combat-related service in an era of prolonged war. The ability of clinicians, policymakers, community service providers, commanders, and researchers to meet the needs of military children was limited by outdated research, inappropriate comparison groups, uneven systems of care, and a lack of evidence-based practices to guide intervention. Fortunately, strategic partnerships grew out of the collaborative efforts of academics, of practitioners, and military leadership united in a common mission to support military children and families. This chapter describes the historical context of research on military children and families, identifying challenges to conducting high-quality research, and delineating best practices for scholarship. The following research-related lessons learned are highlighted: understanding and respecting military family culture, building trust within the community, fostering lasting relationships with the community, building collaborative, multidisciplinary academic research teams, and sustaining a scientific military family program of research. This chapter also has recommendations for future directions for researchers, for military leaders, for the policymakers and funders, and that's discussed as well. I believe Megan's research initiatives are now looking at another life phase of military children as they transition out of childhood into college and university life. We hope that information, that research endeavors such as Megan's, will add to how we think about the needs and the barriers of this population of students in academic settings. It's an important component of military family research. It's not widely researched to date, and a needed component in our understanding of military families and how those that work with military families can adequately provide services that meet those needs. Our next anchored episode will be released in April 2018 and is called Ready, Set, Thrive, A Supportive Approach to Parenting. During this episode, Dr. Jennifer Donnallo talks with us about the Thrive Initiative, which is being developed by Penn State's Clearinghouse for Military Family Readiness and the Department of Defense's Office of Military Community and Family Policy. Here's a brief clip from episode 12, where Jennifer talks about the Thrive Initiative.
So we became really interested in one particular program and shared this information with our partners at the Department of Defense, and they were very interested as well and indicated that we would start developing parenting programs across the lifespan of a child. So that is from birth through age 18. And we were able to really look at what exists out there and what we needed to do in moving forward. And this became our Thrive Initiative. And the Thrive Initiative is actually broken down into four developmentally appropriate parenting program areas. Specifically, we have Take Root, which is a parenting program that's been developed for parents of 0 to 3 year olds. Next is Sprout, and that's for parents of 3 to 5 year olds. Then we have Grow, which is for parents of 5 to 10 year olds or elementary school age children. And then finally, our last program area is called Branch Out, and that is for parents of 10 to 18 year olds.
Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you'd like to hear more episodes from Anchored, check out the links provided on our website, or you can go directly to iTunes. Just enter MFLN Anchored Podcast in your search engine to get you there. We offer continuing education credits for most of our programming. Information about that can be found on our website, or you can just email our team at MFLNFamilyDevelopment@gmail.com. We hope you will join us next time. This material is based on work supported by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Office of Military Family Readiness Policy. U.S. Department of Defense award number is 2015-48770-24368.